Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Today's show is drawn from a panel at the Red May Conference in Seattle, one that was conceived of as a live version of Behind the News. It was supposed to be in person, but like everything else these days, it was held via Zoom on May 21st. I emceed and asked questions. The topic was the current crisis and how to respond to it. The original ran about an hour and 40 minutes. I've boiled it down to 48. You can find the full event with video on YouTube. The panelists have all been on Behind the News before. Jody Dean, professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York, and author most recently of Comrade from Verso. Leo Panitch, professor emeritus of politics at York University in Toronto, and co-author of The Socialist Challenge Today from Haymarket Books. And Assad Haider, one of the founders of Viewpoint magazine, who teaches philosophy at the New School, and is author of Mistaken Identity, also from Verso. Red May bills itself as a month-long festival of radical art and thought, whose lead organizer is Philip Bolstetter. I was invited last year but couldn't make it and was greatly looking forward to this year's edition as a chance to meet with a bunch of good comrades and friends. Alas, that was not to be. Maybe next year we can do it all in person. In any case, many thanks to Philip and his crew for organizing the conference and then reorganizing it as a virtual event. In my introduction, along with taking the measure of the health and economic disasters, I discussed the erosion of the capacity of the U.S. state to deal with the corona crisis, a symptom of a broader rot at the top of our society. Jody Dean opens by taking some exception to the point. So how should we think about this? How should we relate to the state? What should our demands be? What can we expect of this bourgeois state? Can we just organize around it through mutual aid, or do we really need to address the state head on and make demands on it that are short of revolutionary demands?
First, want to think a little bit more about is collapse of state capacity versus a kind of destruction and narrowing of state capacity. The state has a fairly good capacity to send a lot of money into the pockets of the finance sector and the airlines and in particular leading aspects of the bourgeoisie. So it seems quite capable of doing that. Seems like it's also been capable of directing a lot of money into the military. And it's been capable of strengthening police at multiple levels. It's more a matter of the destruction of some aspects of the state and the strengthening of other aspects of the state. And then that suggests that fighting on that terrain is crucial and necessary. So fighting to direct it to meet social needs, that even if we know that we're not going to win that fight with the Republicans that we have, much less the Democrats that we are likely to have, we probably won't win with either one of them, but we can direct our energies towards pushing demands on the state, exposing the fact that there are choices that are made to put efforts in one place rather than another place. So I think, let's think about the destruction of some parts of capacity and then the recognition that that means that some things can work if you push it.
Jody has put it correctly. I just would say for all of you Americans who think that everything bad is only going on in the States, that the lack of preparation is visible virtually in every state around the world. Yeah, you can point to Taiwan as an exception. But, you know, people point to Germany. But if you read the literature on Germany, there's loads of criticism coming from the left on how inequitous it is and how unprepared it was. And so on. There are variations here, but I do think that one has to say that this is a general problem, not just an American problem. And then at the same time, I think a great deal hinges on some very, very small political vectors as to whether the outcome of this is going to be progressive or reactionary. And a great deal here depends on what happens in the empire. So if it turns out that there is an election in November and the Democrats do win, and especially if they win both houses, I really think that there is an enormous opportunity. Not that I have any expectation that Biden will be a socialist, but I don't think that it is at all implausible that the kind of movement that the American left has thrown up behind Sanders will have the kind of effect that would rebuild state capacities in a progressive way. what looks more rational, as Doug was saying, than the Green New Deal from even a, you know, liberal perspective in the face of this crisis? How much sense does it make to have universal health care in the face of it? And one has to say, well, you are right to point to how skewed the means of saving the system is. It is nevertheless the case that the American state has taken on the health expenditures of anybody who ends up in hospital due to COVID-19. You know, that is to be noted. And then in other states, what's quite remarkable is that reactionaries like Boris Johnson are covering 80% to 90% of wages for a significant period, while ideologically covering that by saying there is such a thing as society. This is, after all, the man who is the head of the Tory party, and he is explicitly reneging on Thatcher's theme. And I think that gives us a lot to build on. It allows us, I think, to make inroads of a very significant kind if we're committed enough to it.
Assad, do you have thoughts on that?
I will say, regarding the state, I think that to add to the points that have already been made, I think we need to have a vigilance in how we think about the state in two senses. Because in one sense, we know that there are requirements for public health which require a certain level of control over the population. But we know that the repressive apparatus of the state, if it grows in this sense in response to the crisis, there is very little reason to think that it will roll back its level of control over the population when crisis conditions recede. And so we face that danger of the growth of authoritarianism, which has already been happening under Trump. We can see that in a moment of crisis, authoritarianism can thrive. This is one risk. The second risk, and this is tied to the rise and decline of the Bernie Sanders campaign, which is that we have to be vigilant about the assumption that causing a change in the behavior of the state, causing a change in state policies, will result from entering into the state. Now, a basic tenet of the ideology of parliamentary democracies is that it is by entering into the state that one causes social change. But I think that, and this will be, I'm sure, a major part of the discussion that we have this evening, I think that the Marxist critique shows that this is not a tenable assumption. That is, we cannot simply assume that by entering into the state, entering into the capitalist state, we are able to change its character. So I think this is the second note on which we must be vigilant.
Jody.
I wanted to hold up a couple of things that Leo said. I thought they were really great. And that's the society exists and basically planning. Right? The saying that no one was prepared means an absence of planning. And so there's a way that a socialist platform that's easier to make now than it's been in a long time. And that's arguing for the imperative of planning. Like, that's common sense at this point. Everybody has to recognize the necessity of planning and that society exists. And that's a huge move away from the neoliberal ideology that's been so dominant. So I think those are good places to stand, good legs to stand on for upcoming politics and upcoming political struggles that we have to have. I think I'm less worried about authoritarianism than Assad. Trump has been I wouldn't characterize him so much as authoritarian as I would single-minded on a few things that matter to him, basically his own ratings and his possibilities of re-election, and those hinge on how particular parts of his base respond to him. But I don't think he's been bent on oppressing everyday people. I think he's been, the worst part of his authoritarianism has been the deportation strategies, but that's a continuation of Obama. So I don't think that that counts there. And I don't think that it's the control over population is what's been going on. We've seen huge numbers of people across the United States basically pushing against any kind of state regulation on their behavior in the name of some kind of so-called they're free to spread the virus or free not, you know, to do whatever they please. So I think authoritarianism is less the worry than the absence of a state doing the kinds of things that a state should be doing, namely securing public health, securing a general level of well-being, securing the provision of basic kinds of material like the ventilators and the PPE. And then the last thing is, I actually don't think any Marxists think that just being in parliamentary government means that you win anything. I mean, that's just one of the terrains of fighting, one of the terrains on which people struggle. It doesn't mean getting there is the victory. Getting there is the starting point for another level of fighting, another level of attempt, and of course, failures will come. So I think I would push against the characterization of how Marxists think about participation in parliamentary or bourgeois governments.
Jody, you mentioned the obvious need for planning. And I hear a lot of people across the spectrum, but pretty far on the left, just talking about universal basic income, grants, monetary interventions. But I don't really hear much people talking about intervening in the productive structure, rearranging it or hijacking it for medical equipment. But I'll just, you know, also if we're talking about a Green New Deal, it's going to require massive interventions in the productive sector that, you know, the only precedent in American history for would be World War II mobilization. I don't hear a lot of people talking about that. I hear, you know, like I said, people talking about checks for everyone, but I don't hear people really talking much about how to reorganize production in any meaningful way.
Well, if I could say, Doug, I think the opening is there to do so precisely by virtue of the way in which a General Electric has taken on producing equipment that's necessary for personal protection and indeed for hospital ventilation. The fact that Trump had to use the Defense Production Act to get General Motors to do the same gives us a basis for making this case. I do think that it isn't hard to make the step in this direction. And I also want to respond to Assad's, I think, important point. Of course, in some ways, in my view, it's better that Bernie didn't win. It was always going to be harder for him to win the Democratic nomination than to win the presidency anyway, because the preparation for implementation was not there, and just as it wasn't with Syriza in Greece. So while everybody was enthusiastic about policy or arguing about different policies, etc., there was very little strategic concentration on how the heck will we actually implement this stuff. So when we turn towards it's necessary to enter the state to change it, we need to do that from the perspective of having time to work through how to implement the policies. What would it take to develop now a state that is capable of actually implementing a Green New Deal, given the way state capacities have been diminished? But also, how does one build a degree of support? So in face of the enormous opposition, one can carry people with you. The movement building is connected to the strategy for getting into the state. It's not something separate from it. And as regards, just finished with this, the repressive apparatus, of course. But come on, what has happened now in terms of tracing, compared to the capacity of security intelligence establishment, not only in the United States, but in the Five Eyes, to track down us lefties, you know, this really doesn't add to much more than that. Really. As Jody said, I was astonished this week, just a little vignette. I was driving by the provincial legislature on Saturday to go for a long walk on the lake. And there were people gathered there. And one of them, a woman, was holding a sign saying we are all essential workers. And as a good lefty, when I see with something that looks like a protest or a picket line, I honk. And then I realized that those people were, they were all wearing fatigues. They were, you know, led by some gun lobby here in Ontario. They were protesting the fact that there was preparation being made here in Ontario in a very conservative government to not allow people to yet to go back to work. Who we need to worry about, and what I fear, is that Trump, on the basis of supporters like that, will go even further to do away with what elements of the rule of law and accountability are built into the, or have been built into the American system. This is the most dangerous development that can be visited on the American system.
We're listening to excerpts from a panel at the virtual Red May conference featuring Jody Dean, Assad Haider, and Leo Panitch. Is Trump so dangerous that displacing him is a top priority, even if it's just for Sleepy Joe? Or is that something that socialists should leave to the bourgeois order to decide? Assad, you seemed unwilling to be persuaded by the importance of going for Biden.
a lot of the discussion, it corresponds to a kind of psychoanalytic logic of fantasy. Many liberals are quite scandalized that young radicals aren't enthusiastic for Biden, but whether that has anything to do with what the outcome of the election will be is totally unclear.
Well, they're looking for somebody to blame.
Looking for somebody to blame because the Democratic Party has so consistently bungled this. Yes, absolutely. Young leftists who are skeptical of Biden because they were mobilized by the Sanders campaign are unlikely to constitute a meaningful voting bloc that could actually sway the election, and they don't sway public opinion. The discussion is actually one between competing conceptions of politics and what's politically possible. Is it possible and necessary to advance a conception of politics that goes beyond the limitations of the two-party system? Or do we have to continue to accept year after year, election after election, the premise that politics is reducible to the defense of the status quo against what is perceived to be the exceptional threat? That's what's really at stake, and I think many people are demonstrating a kind of anxiety about the exceptional threat, which is standing in the way of the courage that it takes to fight for real change.
There is no real change that you're going to secure on the basis of one election. That's certainly true. But it is also, I think, mistaken to think that it wouldn't matter that after this mobilization behind Sanders, that a Democratic administration would get in and introduce some labor legislation that would make it easier to engage in the process of class formation. That should be the most important outcome of what's happened since 2016. It's not that the system is going to be changed by Biden, of course not. But even apart from the Popular Front strategy of keeping the fascists out, there's reason to believe, given what has been accomplished by young people on the American left in the last 3-4 years by way of mobilization, that that can have some effects. And we should only look at those effects in terms of what does it then open up in terms of further mobilization. I have to say, not to be worried about the loss of the rule of law in a bourgeois democratic capitalist state seems to me also mistaken.
I was just talking to Jane McAlevey the other day, who said that if you're trying to organize a union, just the personnel, the NLRB really matter. Even if it's Biden, it's going to be a lot better than anything that happens under Trump. Also, the degree of absolute incompetence makes me nostalgic for neoliberal technocracy. Watching this, the management of this pandemic under Trump has been alarming. The class of people around him are such a frightening array of parasites and fools, and it just seems like a house cleaning really is in order.
Is this election one that would give us such a house cleaning? Leah was making a point that I was finding pretty persuasive regarding the kind of breakdown of the rule of law and the firing of the inspector general. Is that the right title? I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's utterly outrageous about the illegal behavior of the people of the Trump administration. And yet I don't see a strong Democratic Party leadership making any headway on this. I don't see them offering up any kind of real courageous opposition. I don't see them fighting that battle. And I think, Leo, I would be a little bit more persuaded if there was a Democratic Party that was exercising any of the kind of defense of, let's say, democratic law or rule of law in a visible and strong sense. And I don't think we see that. So I'm less compelled to think of this particular election that way. And so I'm less compelled by the analogy with the LRB than I would be otherwise. Not thinking in terms of the election, but thinking in terms of mobilization. How do you mobilize people? What are you mobilizing for? That to me makes a lot more sense as a political framing than the kind of myopia of this one particular election.
Can I just clarify Assad can respond fully to this? I wasn't suggesting, Jody, that the Democrats are mobilized to prevent this. I just think that when they're in office, they will simply not do this. That is, they operate within the framework of the bourgeois democratic status quo domestically very largely and the institutional structures they're in. I also agree with Doug that the degree of running down of state apparatuses is something that even the Democrats would not have done. The socialist critique needs to be made, but I do think we are wrong not to be seeing the extent to which this administration is not only running down the apparatus, but is engaged in tarnishing the rule of law in a really problematic way. And why does that matter? It matters because the left needs space to engage in mobilization. And the more democratic space is closed down, the less we're able to do that, unless you think that we can develop the arms to carry through an insurrection that the far right can't. And you know, I still think Gramsci was right about that as regards to advanced capitalist state.
I got an audience question here, which is relevant to this. Is this discussion a question as to if the state is the horizon of necessary action today? Are we focusing too much on the state here?
I would say yes. I do think the state is, let's say, like a temporary horizon for action today. Like, I don't think that we move away from capitalism or an exploitative capitalist system without the state. We can't pretend that civil society organizations and non-state actors will have any of the centralizing capacity to take on capital in any strong sense. So I think that we have to talk about the state. But I also think that the state is, of course, much more complicated than the language of state lets us say, right? Like, for, you know, on the one hand, I mean, Assad's of course right when he mentions that, well, we're talking about a capitalist state, but it's also the case that within the capitalist state, there are multiple different constituencies, there are different elements of it, right? There's a massive bureaucracy that has its own sets of interests. There's a military that has its own sets of interests. We don't help our conversation if we act as if the state is that kind of a unity that we can say that it only cares, as if the state cares at all. I mean, that seems like a strange kind of locution. So I will say the state is a necessary instrument, and we can't get around it.
Do we smash the state? Do we transform it? Do we use it to our advantage? What's the approach to the state?
Marx is very clear on this. It's absolutely clear in the Marxist tradition that smashing the state is part of the aim of a socialist revolutionary politics. What does this mean? It means that the centralized repressive apparatus, which is separate from people and stands over them in their everyday lives, has to be abolished and replaced by mass organizations in which people are able to participate in the decisions that rule over their lives. This is not an extreme or outlandish view, but this is what was meant by smashing the state. I think it remains a basic emancipatory principle. I don't think we can say in the abstract, what should the state be doing now? What would the state's role be? This is once again posing it in the abstract. We're talking about a capitalist state. The capitalist state is interested in our health insofar as we are the bearers of labor power. It will also preserve the conditions in which we are dependent on the market and have to sell our labor power to survive. If these interests conflict, it may opt for the latter. I think we have to keep this in mind. And so the expectation that the state is simply the space of the protection of the public good is not a sustainable conception for the capitalist state. Leo, your teacher, Ralph Miliband, made a point, which was also made by his theoretical adversary, Nikos Poulantzas, at the end of the 1970s, which is that if you have a struggle which enters into the state, you must have forms of organization which are outside of the state, which not only are able to lend support for social democratic reforms, but also exert pressure, exert a fundamental challenge to the ultimately capitalist balance of forces which prevails in the state. Frankly, I've seen a lot of discussion on the socialist left about how we can use electoral politics in our favor, but I have not seen an attempt to elaborate how these electoral efforts can be tied to the development of directly democratic organizations outside the state, which can build what Miliband confusingly called dual power. But that discussion, I think, is not happening. What are the forms of organization outside of the state which will be able to make any meaningful reform possible?
We're listening to a panel from Red May, a month-long event that was supposed to be held in Seattle, but which a damned virus relegated to Zoom. I am seeing the speakers were Jody Dean, Leo Panitch, and Assad Haider. You're listening to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Back after a musical break. How is some of Communist Love Song by Sleepyhead, a bit of Gen X disillusionment with politics that's still very charming. But I'm glad we moved on from the tyranny of ironic detachment. And now on to the second part of a panel from Red May featuring Jody Dean, Asad Haider, and Leo Panitch.
I have to say your characterization of Poulantzas and Miliband on this, Asad, is contrary to what they were actually writing when they wrote this stuff. Their whole point was to criticize the smash the state metaphor. Miliband used, call it dual power if you like, in order to identify the necessity of going into the state and transforming it with while building support outside and capacities outside to be able to go in and change it. The notion that you can build institutional capacities to plan and govern, especially in a democratic way, complex societies without transforming the apparatuses and institutions are there. Even Lenin by 1922 said, all we've done is occupy the institutions of the Tsarist state. There was nothing left of the Soviets by that time, and they didn't have the capacity to. They could be expressions of democratic sentiment, of building collective identity and will, but their administrative capacity was practically zero. We need to be thinking in terms of democratic administration, and that's what Marx said to Bakunin. When Bakunin attacked him for being a statist, he defended what he had laid out by way of state apparatuses after the Paris Commune and said, if you want to call it a state, call it a state. It is absolutely enormously important in our time that there has been a shift from the protest movements, which were very important, from Seattle to Occupy, towards taking that energy and directing it in part to making reform demands on the state. And one would hope, going beyond that, to implementing a change in the state apparatus so that those reforms could open up transformative change. But that can't be done, as I was saying to begin with, and I agree with you, Asad, without the much, much more important thing, which is to take those movements which are oriented to getting into the state and use them to build class capacities outside. And I must say, most practically, that would have to entail taking public sector unions, like the ones that are, whose workers are seeing us through this terrible pandemic, and encouraging them to develop the capacities to change those apparatuses. For now, the public sector unions don't have that on their agenda. They don't see public sector workers' leaders as cadre for changing the state. That's what Marx was talking about.
Jody, any thoughts?
I agree a lot with Leo, especially if we're thinking about this in terms of where are we right now? What does a transition look like? What are the tasks that we see before us in the next few years? What he says makes a great deal of sense. Is that the same thing as the overcoming of capitalism? No. But is it a step towards building the kinds of class and movement and capacity and collective leadership that's necessary? I think yes. We don't do ourselves any favors when we talk right now about smashing the state. It seems to me that that actually takes us back to the beginning of the conversation with the way that the Trump administration has, in effect, destroyed the capacity of the state to intervene in lives that ways that benefit public health, that benefit people's well-being, that generate a kind of capacity to do what a state should do if it weren't just a capitalist state. So I think it kind of comes full circle where smashing the state seems to be what the far right does.
No, the state has done a great deal to support capital. It has enormous willingness to act and intervene in the economy to defend capital. We've seen it happen. That's what's happening right now. What a state should do when it's a capitalist state is precisely to defend the interests of capital. It's doing what it should do. That's the problem. To go to Leo's point, of course it's correct. Both Miliband and Poulantzas are criticizing the conception of smashing the state, and they are advancing this other conception. What's the problem? Why is it that smashing the state did not lead to the institution of Soviet power, of direct democracy on the model of the Soviet? Why? Because there was a gap between the direct democracy of the Soviets and the centralized structure of the capitalist state, which was filled in by the party. This was the problem. There was no theory of forms of organization that could go beyond the centralized party and that could provide an alternative to the centralized structure of the capitalist state. This, I think, was a very important insight of both Miliband and Poulantzas. I think this is a problem that we face now. I don't think that we are able to think of organization when people talk about getting organized, going beyond horizontalism and getting organized. What model do we have that's an alternative to the classical form of the party or simply to the form of the bourgeois parliamentary party? Do we have an alternative to Leninist vanguardism or to bourgeois parliamentarism? Do we have another conception of organization? I think, honestly, the critique of horizontalism by now has become somewhat glib because we have electoral movements that socialists are getting behind, but we don't have a theory of how is it that, Leo, you alluded to public sector unions, but I don't know if that's enough to present an alternative model of democracy to parliamentary democracy.
No, it certainly isn't. And I think what we've all been doing in our different ways is precisely trying to think our way through to the type of class agencies that are capable of seeing through a socialist transformation. And I certainly agree that one doesn't start with the state. One starts with trying to build those agencies. It's been obvious to my generation since the 60s that the mass parties of the working class that emerged between the 1870s and World War I, or even in the 1920s, had lost their capacity to do that by the 1960s. What my generation has not managed to do, and I hope yours will, is develop new mass parties capable of that and having themselves the institutional apparatus and framework to be more horizontalist and be more capacity building, to be directive vis-a-vis public sector union in terms of you need to be developing your members as cadre to change the state. And that isn't going to be done without building such parties. The trouble is, yes, there isn't a formula for this. We are in a process of discovering how to do this. We have things to learn from the mistakes that were made. We have things to learn from those who tried to turn both communist parties and social democratic ones into agencies like that and failed to do so. That's why I've just finished this book on the project of the Labor New Left from Ben to Corbyn. They were searching for socialism above all in that sense. Much more importantly, in terms of how do we democratize these parties, make them agencies of mass education and capacity building, rather than just policy machine. That was precisely what the project was about. The likelihood of transforming a party like Labor, of course, was always pretty small. But one can learn from that in terms of developing the capacity, I hope, in the 21st century to build such parties.
And Jody, a lot of talk about parties. Any thoughts?
I still want to push back Assad that the capitalist state is doing what it should do and doing what it's supposed to do. I mean, actually, we're in a situation of pretty incredible, close to economic collapse with, 40 million people unemployed, the pressure on different states in the U.S. for unemployment breaking their budgets. We've got the total upheaval back and forth in the stock market and a real crisis around the economy and production. So it seems like it doesn't make sense to say that this state is doing what a state should do, or just saying, well, it's doing that, but it just does it completely badly. So I will push there. And then on organizational question, the Vanguard Party idea is not over and should still be considered, emphasized, fought for, put in energy put into, that there were mistakes in the past that it didn't work doesn't mean it can't, that it's irretrievable. We have to do the work and see what happens. So this goes back to what Leah was saying. It's like there's a kind of period of now experimentation, whether or not it's at the level of the unions, more energy is going back into unions than there has been in a long time, at least in the United States, particularly unions that are in these areas of social reproduction, like nurses and teachers and public sector. That's important. And then we have a return to the mainstream parties and party work, like with around Corbyn and Sanders. And then we have the kind of organized socialists between the kind of mainstream DSA and then the other smaller parties. It's not like we have to attack any one of these. Rather, it's like we need to invest in them, invest our energies and time, and try to forward all of them to have a really thriving ecosystem. And if I think about like the 30s, I mean, the 30s, there were multiple kinds of communist and socialist organizations, all the way through civil society, education, unions, and the parties. So it wasn't like, oh, you know, we have to trash this kind as vanguardist so that the other ones would flourish.
I got a question here from Philip, our host. Forget Biden. Imagine Bernie or AOC elected president. Their challenge is not to get grotesquely undemocratic state institutions to deliver outcomes they can't. Like Allende, their challenge is to mobilize part of the state and the movement outside it to destroy those grotesque institutions by delegitimating. But yeah, what would a Bernie or an AOC in office be capable of doing?
Very little. Something. It would depend, of course, on the balance of forces in the Democratic Party and in the Congress after they got in. But I think it would have proved rather disappointing, not only because there weren't the forces built from the outside, but also because the implementation planning wasn't there. Even insofar as one assumes that what they're about is what we seem to be all agreeing on, which is that we're trying to change a capitalist state into something that would be on the road to becoming a socialist one. I entirely agree with Assad that the main function of the capitalist state is to reproduce capital accumulation and class relations of production. Of course, that's the case. That said, the state, nevertheless, with that function, is a field of struggle. And I think to bury our heads in the sand, as we see around us, so much opportunity to carry that struggle inside the state as people point to essential workers, as people back essential workers, frontline workers. This gives us an opportunity for mobilization around a class politics that takes us somewhere. You can't merely appeal to people on the basis of the long-run goal of socialism. You have to articulate that. You have to make them want it. You have to offer people immediate reforms. You don't have to tell a Leninist that. That's what Lenin knew. That's why it was peace and bread. You have to offer people that. And we have an enormous opportunity in the current conjuncture to be able to advancing that. When right-wingers are carrying signs saying we are all essential workers, we have to turn that into our slogan with our meaning rather than say, well, you know, 50 years from now, we'll build the kind of socialist party that will be able to carry through an insurrection.
I agree with that. You know, I live in Geneva, New York, and it's a town of about 12,000 people in between Rochester and Syracuse. And we've been doing the celebrate our Thank Essential Workers solidarity action every night at 6 o'clock. And what's been so interesting is there's been a struggle over the definition in the community over the definition of essential workers, where the right wing is trying to always say first responders are essential workers, where first responders really, they mean police. And so they keep wanting to make this a pro-police action, where, you know, our group is like, no, we started this. This is like, we're talking about the non-citizen agricultural workers, the farm workers, the hospital workers, the people in the grocery store, the delivery people. That's what we're talking about. We're even talking about, you know, all of the, the people having to take care of their kids at home, right? That's an essential labor now. All of the teachers who are having to teach from remote, that's essential labor. But so it's been real, but it's interesting that the struggle is around who's an essential worker. Now, so that's full stop on that point. When I get depressed, I start to think, oh, God, you know, where the way this is going to start to look is that the essential workers are going to go back to just be these awful capitalist finance tech and tech people as the real workers, right, the ones who we all depend on, start to be forced back to work, right? I'm really worried about how this essential worker struggle is going to be. Like, does this help build the kind of support to enable strikes? Does this build the support to enable essential workers not to go back to work? Or are we going to keep getting this twisted where somehow the essential nature of these workers starts to vanish? I don't know. I think it's a real front line of politics right now.
We're listening to excerpts from a panel at the virtual Red May conference featuring Jody Dean, Assad Haider, and Leo Panitch. Well, we're down to the last 15 minutes of this. So this is the time, I guess, to look ahead. As we journalists do in our debased way. Can something good come out of this hellscape?
It's sort of a perverse question in a way, right? I always feel like finding something good is not just a silver lining, but there's something sort of perverse of like, oh, like, you know, the bright side of the bubonic plague.
When
you say it like that, right? But now you're saying, well, what's the bright side of the,
Well, it phrases the question.
Not to be super moralistic, but we should say, right, what is it, over 90,000 people in the United States have died, or around 90,000 people in the United States have died. And across the world, what's the number of deaths? Is it 300,000 people?
Well, we have like a quarter of them, so yeah, multiply by four. Yeah,
and so that seems something worth sitting with and acknowledging. And then I would say as socialists, and communist, we should say that laying bare of the contradictions and laying bare of the both the contradictions of capitalism and the fragility of its order, those are both developments that can be useful for our politics.
I think it's going to be revealed that for all of the success of the central banks, above all, the World Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, in containing this from becoming a financial conflagration, an uncontrolled one. Apart from that, managing this is going to be extremely difficult. And the contradictions in capitalist states trying to manage it is going to be revealed. It is being revealed. It's going to be revealed all the more. It's going to magnify the extent to which the states of the quote-unquote developing world are not given the types of room, facilities, capacity to deal with the problem as the pandemic sweeps there, because the central banks are taking care of the advanced capitalist world primarily. It's going to expose the ugliness of a transnational capitalist system and a financial system. So because of the difficulty of managing this, that is not to say that, you know, when things get worse, you know, the prospects for socialism necessarily get better. But I think that does give us space. And then I want to come back to where we started. Look, for there to have been a popularizing of the word socialism, however much that may have been social democratic in its aspirations, i.e. what I want is Denmark, or even worse, what I want is Canada. you know, for the word socialism to be legitimated in so many eyes behind the campaign for universal public health care just before this happened, my God, that gives us a basis for continuing to develop class consciousness in the United States. In Britain, while I entirely agree with Jody about the class differences around broadband not being necessarily changed by this, given the conditions working class people live in, et cetera, et cetera, Corbyn's demand, the Labour Party's demand in the 2019 December election for public free broadband was derided by most people as a bribe to the voters. Now you see it as an essential service. Here in Toronto, there were lines down the block for people to get into Service Canada to put in their unemployment claims, and you realize it's because people don't have broadband at home. They go to the library or the coffee shop in order to be able to put in an application. That itself created a health crisis. So there is an opening here for us to make a case for common ownership in all kinds of spheres, and Jody was right to point right at the beginning for the need for planning. In order for that to happen, for the need for finance to be a public utility, whatever concretely that ever means, Doug and I are always worrying over
yeah.
to translate that practically.
It's a nice slogan.
It's a nice slogan. And it's actually an essential idea. But how to do it in a way that connects with the type of planning that we need to be getting on the agenda. You know, I think we have a lot of reasons to feel that we've got some wind behind our sails, rather than be depressing ourselves with how terrible these capitalist states are proving to be.
I believe that this moment is one of major transformation. We have many surprises ahead. I don't think we have a good idea of what's in store for us. I think a lot will change. At the same time, some things I think remain consistent, and I think in some senses those are the most fundamental things. If we look over the whole history of the 20th century, the scale of devastation that capitalism has wreaked on the world is extreme. We've already seen extreme levels of starvation, imperialist terrorism, genocide. This is all part of the history of capitalism up to the present. We've always been fighting against this. And we have an exceptional moment now, but the underlying problem is still there. And the response is still the same. The response is to say that we should live in a world in which nobody goes hungry. That has not changed. And the challenge of realizing that has not changed. We always had to present an affirmative politics. An emancipatory politics was never simply given by a situation. It was never the automatic result of a crisis, as though suddenly the crisis revealed to everyone that the system is rotten and then we would have this transformation. You always had to have the affirmative proposal of an emancipatory politics, which said, we can live differently than how we live. We still need that. And what we need, just as we needed before, is a program and a strategy and an organization which can implement an emancipatory politics. And we have not found the solution to that yet. Many attempts were tried throughout the 20th century. I believe that we have to learn from their failures just as much from their successes. I don't believe we can just implement the model and say, well, okay, let's bring back the party and that will solve it. I think this is a major challenge that we have to think through anew in the present.
Hear, hear.
Isn't that what intellectuals always say? Oh, everything we need new concepts. We have to think through this anew. So let's, you know, we need to go back. We need to think about all this stuff. It's like, well, sure. Leo's like shaking his head, but it seems like this is the line that intellectuals always have, is that, you know, we have to think about things. And no one's going to say don't think, for crying out loud, right? So if one recognizes that what's necessary is a program and a strategy and organization, then being involved in an organization an organization that has a program and that can try to implement a strategy is a step forward. And to say, well, I don't see one that exists, you know, okay, that's something, right? But then that just sort of brings one to be in a place without a program and without a strategy. I take the view that one needs to be in a party to put forward these arguments and to make that kind of strategy happen. Because if not, like the general left can't form a strategy. That's not what a general left does. A crowd can't form a strategy. A movement can't form a strategy, but organizations within movements can form strategies. So if we recognize the importance of strategy, then that means building the organizations capable of implementing them.
Let me appoint myself to Assad's defense attorney. I thought that's what he was saying, Jody. I really took him to be saying exactly that. And he didn't begin by saying we need to rethink, we need to think. He said we need to assert that nobody should go hungry. We need to assert a necessity of emancipation. And then he said we need to find the means of doing that. Now, I think he was quite right then to say there isn't a party form out there that we can latch on to. We are in the process of discovery. One doesn't exist. And in any case, there won't be a single one. And part of the problem with the small parties that emerged out of the crisis of the large ones in the 1960s was that each of them thought they had the formula. That was one of the problems. And unfortunately, most of them were borrowing that formula from the Bolshevik Revolution in a very different context in a very different time.
And so then, the next set of responses is, so I'll just keep talking about it and then talk about developing rather than being in the small party to try to build it and let it adapt to something, right? So it doesn't mean that there were these kind of all these problems with the proliferation of small parties in the 70s doesn't mean that parties are hopeless. That conclusion isn't right.
So who's concluding that?
You keep stopping before you get to what organizational form you think would be possible, right? And what I'm saying is that I think you develop that organizational form through practice.
I agree.
Within the organization.
You want to send me a membership card, Jody? We have tiny little parties. We're trying to build ones that have much greater capacities. And we haven't discovered how to do that. We need, I would entirely agree, we need to be trying to do that.
Assad, you want to have the last word?
I'll just end by adding even more controversy, and I just wanted to say, look, there's a very difficult task we have to do when we think about the history of the 20th century revolutions, which is to recognize that with the model of the party, the Revolutionary Party, they achieved a scale of transformation that seems almost unthinkable to us today. But at the same time, that this was a severe limitation on the scope of their emancipatory potential, because when the party became the state, human emancipation was foreclosed. And I think that we have to think of a form of emancipation. We have to think, and people think. Everybody thinks. People think every day. Workers think. It's not just intellectuals. And they're capable of thinking of a kind of emancipation that goes beyond the party becoming the state. I think it's possible, and I think it's necessary.
Those are excerpts from a panel I emceed for the Red May Festival on May 21st that was supposed to be held in Seattle, but which was exiled to Zoom for obvious reasons. The panelists were Jody Dean, professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York, and author most recently of Comrade from Verso, Leo Panitch, professor emeritus of politics at York University in Toronto, and co-author of The Socialist Challenge Today from Haymarket Books, and Assad Haider, one of the founders of Viewpoint magazine, who teaches philosophy at the New School and is author of Mistaken Identity, also from Verso. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a bit of a new song from the Gang of Four, Forever Starts Here, written by their guitarist Andy Gill, who died on February 1st, which they've just posted to SoundCloud. Till next week, bye.